Hello, beautiful. And what I really want to know is what's good in your life today? This is Kia, and this is the season 9 premiere introduction. I just wanted to say thank you so much for all of your support. If you have been watching my other podcast, Hot Topics Live, hashtag podcast on YouTube or on Facebook, then you know that I just had a surgery, so I had to take a little time off. Big one. I had a hysterectomy and they removed a lot of stuff. but they left my ovaries. And I know many of you have had that experience. But leading up to it was such a painful, painful experience for me. I had a lot of benign tumors, big ones, and I looked about 6 months pregnant, and so my body felt uncomfortable, you know, and it was always feeling like it was growing and it was painful. And I'm a single mom and I also do performance coaching. A lot of you may know that. And I do these female veteran workshops and things of that nature. And I appear on other podcasts. And, you know, I've been trying to create a podcasting group to teach people how to podcast or for indie podcasters that want to be part of a membership group, to be part of a community. I've been creating this to launch this summer. And so I've been doing all of these things while in massive pain. And many of you know what that's like because many of us are disabled veterans and we live in pain. So I was already living in pain and then we add this to it. And so I slowed down a bit, my sisters, but I'm back. I am back with the season 9 premiere. And this one is an amazing, amazing episode. I love this episode. It was so emotional for me. It was such an honor for Diana to share her story of survival and the things that she had to overcome and just her openness and her vulnerability just makes this such an amazing episode. So I hope you really enjoy it. And I want to say thank you so much for coming on this journey with me. In July, it will be 5 years of the Female Veterans Podcast. And I can hardly believe it. I can hardly believe it. But thanks to all of you, I'm still going strong. I might have slowed down a little bit, but I'm still going. And I appreciate each and every one of you. When I first started, I was so scared. I thought, who is going to listen to me? Who's going to want to share their story with me? And right out the gate, there were so many people who wanted to share. And I am just endlessly honored by that. And I'm endlessly grateful for that. And so I just want to say thank you. And please continue to listen and share with other female veterans. In fact, share with other women so that they know what it's like to be a woman serving in the military. This is not just about, you know, being a veteran. It's about being a woman and what we endure as women. So thank you for sharing. Don't forget to follow me on Instagram. I am going to be doing a little bit more there now that I'm feeling much better. As soon as my doctors give me the go-ahead to really get back to work. And there's a newsletter coming as well. So make sure you head on over to www.thefemaleveteranspodcast.com to submit your email so you can be included in that when it's live. And there's so many more great episodes coming that I can't wait to share with you. So, again, thank you so much for listening. I love you guys, and stay tuned for the season 9 premiere of the Female Veterans Podcast. Hello, beautiful. And what I'd like to know is, what's really good in your life today? I'm Kia, and this is another episode of the Female Veterans Podcast. Today, I have Diana with me, and I am so excited to have her here. She is a 10-year Army veteran, and we're going to talk all about her experiences and what she's doing now, which is definitely something really close to my heart. And we're going to talk about her homeless ministry. So this is going to be a good one. Stick with us till the end. You don't want to miss that. And I want to say to you, Diana, welcome.
Thank you, Kia, for having me on the show. I appreciate your time today.
Oh, it's the pleasure is all mine, hon. The pleasure is all mine. So let's jump right into it. What made you join the military?
I grew up with a really tough background, a pretty rough upbringing where I experienced child abuse, emotional, physical, some sexual abuse. And my parents didn't make the right decisions growing up. I had one parent who was addicted to drugs and one who leaned into alcohol and was stuck in depression. And a lot of people told me I was going to turn out just like my mom. And as much as I love her for being a strong single mother, after a while, I didn't want to take the same path that she took, and I didn't want to make same choices. So I promised myself that I would break cycles in my family and I would do something different. I was basically homeless at 17 because I had such a terrible attitude that nobody wanted to deal with me. And I just honestly didn't know how to deal with what I was going through at home. But I had a church who helped me, and they put me in an extended stay hotel until I turned 18. So it was about 6 months or so. And then I was helped into my own first apartment. They helped me furnish it with like donations from like a warehouse or something like that. Nothing new or anything like that, but I was thankful to have it. But with that, I was a senior in high school and I was running out of options because I had to work two, sometimes three jobs to pay for my bills. And so I lost scholarships. My grades dwindled because there was just a lot of pressure at that age. My older brother had joined the military about 2.5, maybe 3 years before me, and he seemed to have been doing well, and I typically did a lot of what he did and followed in his footsteps, so he kind of led the way, and I went to go talk to a recruiter and enlisted and said, I'm going to take control of my future, and I'm not going to turn out how everybody thinks I'm going to, and I did.
I 1,000% identify with a lot of what you just said. If you don't listen to my other podcast, Hot Topics Live, hashtag podcast, you may not know this about me, but I am a child abuse survivor. And I grew up in a very difficult household with two mentally ill guardians, like two people that were parental figures that were suffering with their own mental disorders. So it was a very difficult upbringing. And my saving grace was the Milton Hershey School and being accepted to that school. And that's how I kind of got out of that regularly. But I also left to the military. My exit strategy was college, but we didn't have the money for college. So, I mean, I didn't know what my options are, and what you don't know, you don't know. And in our communities, a lot of African-American communities or Black communities, whatever you prefer the term to be, they don't teach a lot of options. So, and even at my boarding school, they didn't really explain to me what all my options were and what the steps were. So I was just trying to figure it out. I had a career counselor and everything, but my mother had wanted me to go to the military. I've said that story a million times on this podcast. So I did. I did what she asked of me to do. And I ended up going to the military as a way to get money for college, because that was always my end goal, right? But I was also trying to get out of a situation. Like, I knew when I left home that I wasn't going back home, right? It wasn't a situation that was going to be healthy or productive for me. And I knew that from going to private school, because it was vastly different. And it provided me a lot of the opportunities that I would have never even known were an option. So I could definitely see why, from your situation and going to your church, was that for you? They gave you a way out. They gave you a place to stay. But as a young woman, like just as a still a teenager, that's a lot of responsibility to basically be on your own at that young of an age. So I definitely see why going into the military would make sense for you. So tell me, what was boot camp like for you?
Boot camp was fun. I'm not gonna lie. I mean, I was scared. I questioned my ability. And I know a lot of my family did too. They were saying like, there ain't no way she's going to make it, right?
Wow.
One, I didn't like being yelled at. Like back then, I'm telling you, I had a really bad attitude because I was angry with the world, just like,
right.
My upbringing and just feeling unloved and unwanted. And I just felt like you couldn't tell me nothing. And so going into boot camp was a hard, I guess, wake up for me. And the only thing I was honestly scared of was the gas chamber.
That sucked.
It did. But I remember getting on that bus, like, well, we flew. I was with like a group of three or four people who I didn't even know, but you know, we all happened to go in at the same time. And I remember getting to Atlanta, Georgia, and then I think we got bussed there or something. Because I remember getting on this white bus, and then like it was like late at night, like 11 or 12, something like that, really late because it was dark. We pulled up to the AG, I don't even know what the heck it was called. I want to call it headquarters, but it probably wasn't headquarters. But you know where your intake and like sergeant's
taken. Yeah.
Remember the Joe Sergeant's jumping on the bus, like, get the F off the bus. And I'm like, oh Lord, what did I sign myself up for? Oh my gosh. And I learned to move quick, like immediately. So like it was an experience, but it was fun. Looking back on it, I'm like, I like the obstacle courses. I got fit. I met my best friend through boot camp, and like it was fun. I'd do it again.
You know what's funny? As I look back on that time too, and I definitely got a train. So my recruiters came and picked me up from home because I had signed up when I was 17, but I had to wait till I was done high school. So instead of like all the college admission stuff, I just took the ASVAB and got ready, did my MEPS physical and all of that and got ready, right? And they came and got me. And because I had enlisted by where I went to private school, which is in Hershey, and the main city there is Harrisburg, so Pennsylvania. So I had to leave from Harrisburg. So they came and drove me from Philly to Harrisburg. And then they put me on a train now, like an Amtrak train, to Chicago because I was going to the Navy, right? So I was going to Naval Training Center, Great Lakes. So then from there, I had to take the Metra. The Chicagoans know what I'm talking about. This Metra rail from the city, downtown Chicago, up to North Chicago. And then you get off of that and it's like a little bit of a walk, but I had to walk, I don't know, maybe half a mile, if that, from the train station to the gates of the training command. So I walked through the gates, right? And I went up to the gate guard and I reported, right? And then they sent me where I had to go. But I will tell you, as I walked through those gates and I was looking around and I was seeing all those recruits in their Smurf sweatsuits from back in the day, you know what I'm talking about. And they were all marching and stuff, looking around. And I said the same thing you did. I was like, what did I get myself into? I am this new age hippie. All my friends said the same thing as you, but it wasn't for the same reason. They were like, what are you doing? You don't belong in the military. I cannot believe you're going to the military. But it wasn't because I was a badass. It was because I was such a hippie. So like, love one another. You are not going to make it. Like, what are you doing? And I got there and I thought, they are right. I am not going to make it. But you know what? I had fun too. I met amazing females and males. And I will say, and I think I've said this before, but I will say it again. When boot camp was over, I was sad. How did you feel when boot camp was ending? Did you have that same experience, like bittersweet?
It was bittersweet for sure. I remember having this like sense of pride because I was like, I did it. Like I did it of all people. You know what I'm saying? I got rid of that. They really did transform me though. Like I got rid of that attitude quick. I fell in the line. I was in a leadership position. I was just a squad leader, but it was cool. And they built me up. You know, they broke me down. I remember one night crying. I remember seeing people do it throughout the day, but you know, at night one time, I don't know what it was that happened. I couldn't tell you why, but I remember crying myself to sleep that night and just like, man, like I need to change, right? Something needs to change. And I think it clicked in me finally. And I remember after that night, like everything was different. I was just excited to get it done. We were almost there. It was like teamwork, make the dream work type thing, you know? And just being able to stand on that parade field, knowing that I accomplished it, what I myself thought I couldn't do and what other people for sure thought I couldn't do, mm-hmm. I was proud of that moment. And it was bittersweet because it was on to the next, you know?
Quick. On to the next quick. So what was your next duty station? Was AIT?
AIT, but it was actually at the same place. So I was in Fort Jackson, South Carolina. And this is why I say I met my best friend. So my best friend, her name is Rondell Logan. She was with me in boot camp in the same platoon. And she was a squad leader with me. And then she went to AIT with me. And then we got stationed at Fort Carson, Colorado together. Isn't that crazy? And we got deployed together. Ain't that crazy?
That is incredible.
Unheard of. I know.
Wow. So, okay. So shout out to you, girl. Number one. Number two. Okay. So you didn't have to go it alone. So what was it like, you know, just going through that whole experience at AIT? Well, what was your MOS?
42 Alpha. So it's human resources specialist. And I thought it was easy. Honestly, I wanted to be a medic when I came in, but mm-hmm. my ASVAB scores weren't very high. You know what I'm saying? So I did end up retaking like later on and they were high enough, but like I never reclassed or anything like that. So I learned how to do human resources for the Army. And I only took that job because the recruiter said he thought it'd be a good fit for me. I didn't know what I was getting into. I didn't know what a 42 Alpha was. I just said, okay, sign me up. I'm going. And she happened to sign up as 42 Alpha as well. And it was good. It's a good job that transitioned for the most part pretty well into the civilian sector. It is different. That's for sure. But it takes well when you get out. So it was good. I liked it.
So that recruiter knew what they were talking about.
Yeah, he took care of me. Thankfully, I didn't have that recruiter that like lied, you know?
Girl, I hear all the stories and I was hearing the stories from boot camp of the recruiter lied stories. Now mine, he didn't really lie. Okay. He was truthful about one thing. He said, in the Navy, you will have the most fun. In the Navy, you will have the most fun. And I had the most fun in the Navy. Like that was no lie. Did I see the world? No. Okay. Bill Clinton was in office. Enough said. But I did not do that. But I had a lot of fun in Chicago. And I, like you, I didn't move a lot. So I went to boot camp in Chicago. I went to A school, as we call it, in Chicago. And then I was staff at the hospital in Chicago. I was medic. So I was a hospital corpsman, as we call it in the Navy. And so, but the reason I got that job was because my recruiter was like, so what do you want to do? And I was like, I don't know. I have no clue. And I was 17, right? And he's like, well, what are your interests? And I said, well, I like, because I had struggled with my weight most of my life. So at that stage of the game, I was very into fitness and I was very into dieting and nutrition. So I said, I like nutrition. I like working out. And he said, nutrition, they work in the hospital. That's how I got my job. Now, fortunately, I was lucky because once I got through school and I became staff, I realized that I did not want to be like, it was more like either you were kind of like a nurse or you were like a physician's assistant, or you had like your specialty careers, or you could go to field med, which I did contemplate doing. So it came down to going to field med or doing a C school, and it was going to be optometry or pharmacy. And it ended up that I switched with a girl and did OJT into the pharmacy. And I ended up being like a pharmacist. And because in the military, you have all the same rights and responsibilities as a pharmacist, not like you would say a pharmacy tech on the civilian world is completely different. In the military, you're just the same as a pharmacist. So I loved that. That's what I ended up doing, but I never went anywhere either. And I did have one friend. We weren't in boot camp together. She was in another company going through, like, I think she was maybe a week ahead of us. It might've been the same time because we arrived at A school at the same time. So maybe we were going simultaneously, but she was in a different company and she ended up in my A school class and we became best friends there. But I'd seen her at boot camp, but I didn't know her. And then we ended up becoming staff at Great Lakes together too. So similar, but different. So I feel that vibe. I feel that vibe. So once you got done with school, what was your active duty, like, staff experience like?
So I actually did go a few places after that. We both, of course, went to Fort Carson, Colorado. I was deployed to Afghanistan for a year. And then after that, I got stationed in South Korea for a year, Washington, and then I finished out in Hawaii. But it was cool.
That's cool.
It was. The staff positions itself was, it was pretty typical. You know, everybody talked crap about human resources. We got all the bad reps say, you lose this, you lose that, you're a phobic, you're this, you're that. But I did earn the respect of my peers just from my circumstances and things that I overcame. So I think that I believe in God, and I think that God placed my best friend on my path because he knew I needed someone, right? When we went to Fort Carson, I met somebody, a guy who was older than me by a couple of years, and we got real close, started dating and all of that. And he asked me not to marry him at the time, but to wait for him because he was about to be deployed with my best friend's unit. So when we got to Fort Carson, she was in 4th Brigade, I was in 3rd Brigade. So we're in different brigades. They were gearing to get ready to go to Afghanistan. My unit was Rear D, and they were coming back from Iraq. So he was in their unit, and they were about to deploy. So he deployed. I broke down. And my NCO at the time had told me, like, you realize you guys are on different deployment cycles. I'm like, deployment cycle? What's that? And she said, when he comes back from Afghanistan, you'll either be in Iraq or be headed to Iraq at that time. You guys won't see each other anymore because you're on different deployment cycles. And I'm like, right. What do I do? And she was like, well, you do know that things happen. Females get pregnant, people get hurt. There's profiles that limit you from going to deploy. And so she's like, you can volunteer to deploy with his unit and it'll be a 1-for-1 swap. So I did that, right? You gotta love somebody to deploy to Afghanistan for them, let me tell you.
But for real.
I deployed to Afghanistan for him because I wanted to be on the same deployment cycle. And I just so happened to be put in the Brigade S1, which is the Brigade Human Resources shop with my best friend, Logan. She was in the same shop. We didn't always have the same hours, but like we worked in the same exact building, same exact office, which was really cool.
That is
fast
cool.
Forward. Yeah, it was awesome. I needed her. Fast forward 2 weeks before we were supposed to go home on R&R, which is like your deployment leave in between. We were about, I want to say, 8 or 9 months in, because this was in February, and we were due to redeploy in end of May, early June. Well, he was killed in action while we were out there. And so 2 weeks before, me and him were supposed to go meet his family, and he was going to propose. Like, he already gave me a ring, wrote it in a letter that he asked me to marry him. I said yes. It was a very, very, very difficult time in my life. And that's why I say I feel like God placed her there for me because he knew that I needed her. But thank God my unit sent me home.
So wait a minute, because this is a first actually for this podcast. Like, we talk about this stuff all the time, but I haven't interviewed anyone who has said that their significant other was KIA. So, honey, how did you find out, first of all?
The funny thing is, I worked in casualties. So I worked with the medics downrange. That's one part of HR that's not really done on the U.S. side from my experience, but it's definitely done in a deployment environment where we track casualty reports and all of that. And I was actually that person. However, I think, and this is where I say I believe in God, because I think God knew I couldn't handle that if I saw his name come across. And I had just got moved to awards a month or so before this happened. And I always thank God, like, I didn't see his name come across those reports, but I was definitely impacted by the things that I read and the things that I seen. But when the report came in, one of my former NCOs kind of looked at me in a way that I knew something was wrong, but they didn't say anything to me. And I remember we had these little Afghani push phones, like not like a flip, but like a real old school, just like all you could do was see a screen and push. Mm-hmm. And I remember texting Logan and saying, hey, something's wrong. And she was like, oh, no, keep your head up. It's okay. It's okay. But something definitely was wrong. And I remember back then we'd have what you call a blackout. Like, you couldn't talk to anybody about the name of the report, nothing until the family was notified. And so nobody was supposed to tell anybody anything. But I remember her going in to tell the major, that was protocol because she was within our leadership line on that side of the house. But I remember they had also talked to my direct line NCO and the person over her, which was unheard of because they were in two completely different sections that had nothing to do with casualties. So from the instant that I seen that look in her face, I knew something was wrong. And I remember getting overwhelmed with emotion and just going in and out of the office. Like, this is the condensed version, okay? going into the bathroom, like grabbing water, trying to get myself together, because in the military, you can't cry. At least back then, right? Back, this is 2010, okay? February 2010. So you couldn't really show emotion other than like anger back then. And so I was trying to get my whole life together in that moment, but I knew something was wrong. And she had pulled out two red folders and three blue folders. A red folder meant KIA, died of wounds or very seriously injured, or it could have meant missing in action. That was so rare. A blue folder meant that it was either routine or like not that bad. Like, they could be basically sent back within a day or two, you know, or the same day. And I remember praying, just like, please God, let it be a blue folder. But I didn't know what it was. And so they called in my best friend, which it didn't hit me until like later. And I talked about all this because I dealt with this for years. Let me tell you, it took years of therapy for me to get to this level where I could talk about it without crying. But they had her take me to lunch, which was typically my dinner because I worked a swing. So I worked from like middle of the night into middle of the day, basically. And then afterwards I would eat, work out, go to sleep, right? I couldn't eat and I was just overwhelmed with anxiety and worry. And she was trying to calm me down. She's like, Soriano, everything's going to be okay. That's my last name. Everything's going to be okay. But she never called me Soriano. Most people butchered my last name and she was one of the first ones to do that. So her nickname for me out of endearment is Reno, because she said Sereno instead of Soriano, right? And so it's always been Reno. That's our thing. To this day, she called me Reno. But she called me Soriano in that moment and didn't realize. And to me, I picked up on that like so quickly. But why are you calling me Soriano? Well, something's wrong, Logan. But like, I didn't tell her. I'm just thinking it in my head. So we finish, she goes into work, I come back to my room, and I'm like, they let me go home, like, well, not home, but, you know, to my room. So I'm like, maybe he's not, maybe, like, he's just really hurt. My mind never went to, he's killed. My mind always went to, like, he lost a limb, like, he's really hurt, never that he was gonna be killed. And I remember pacing back and forth in my room, and I felt crazy, because I was yelling at myself out loud, like, no, like, he promised me he was coming home. Like, we're about to go on R&R together. Like, he's gonna be okay. Like, knock it off, basically, you know? And I got a knock on my door. And when I got the knock on my door, it was my first line leader, Sergeant Tejeda. And I remember looking at her, and she was just so, like, solemn. Like, just doing her job. Like, like how she's trained, right? No emotion, no nothing. And she said, hey, they need you at the office. And I locked eyes with her because she didn't want to look at me. She was avoiding eye contact. And I locked eyes with her and I said, Tejeda, please, like, know anything, please tell me. And she said, no, I don't. Like, doing her best to keep a straight face, but I could see the force of trying to hold herself back in her face, right? In her expression. So I left it at that. When we walked back to the office, and it was not far at all, but I'm telling you, it felt like a 3-mile walk. I felt like I had lead in my legs. Like, I had all this pressure in my chest. My ribs were trembling, like, just all this overwhelming emotion. And I remember walking through the corridors because we went in through the back, she put the photo, the talk, walked through. And then I got walked to where my Sergeant Major's office was. And my NCOIC was there, Sergeant Ocampo. And I remember at that point, I couldn't hold back the tears. They just started to flow. And I remember like saying, "Sergeant Ocampo, like, please." And he just pointed across from the sergeant major's office into this room that had a table, two fold-out chairs, and like a brown, dark brown leather couch. And I remember my major was sitting on the leather couch. And then he stayed at the door. She pointed for me to sit at the folded chair. And then I had the table to my right. So I'm at tables to my right. I'm facing the door, sitting in this chair. And then the sergeant major came in with the chaplain. And the sergeant major, we work close with sergeant major because we always gave him the numbers and all that stuff, right, on the battlefield and all that. But the sergeant major came in, he grabbed my hand, and he just said, Soriano is POC Pagan, your fiance. I mean, it was specialist Pagan. Specialist Pagan, your fiance. And I remember saying, like, yes, sergeant major. And he said, I'm sorry to inform you, but he was killed in action out on the battlefield today. In his own words, I believe he was saying, like, he was out on patrol and he was killed in action out on the battlefield today. And after that, I know he said other things, but my mind went black. Everything went blank for, like, what felt like an eternity, but it was, like, seconds, right? And I remember just those words resonating in me. And I just got up and I screamed. And I was just like, no, like, let me not cry. Lord help me with this. I was overwhelmed because I wasn't expecting that. And every ounce of discipline that I had in me to not show emotion was out the window. And I know that they understood in that moment and that they respected that in that moment. And I remember my NCYC Sergeant Ocampo reaching for me. Or maybe I reached for him. Sorry, it's a blur kind of now because it was so long ago. But I remember I did lean over to him and I looked at him and I almost begged him, like, Sergeant Ocampo, please tell me they're lying. Like, please. And that's when he reached for me and hugged me. And he was just like, I'm sorry. And then I remember, like, almost like all of them were coming towards me trying to hug me or embrace me, but I felt surrounded, and I just remember like standing up and screaming, like, no, I want Logan. And so my NCOIC, like, I could be demanding, right, but I'm telling you, like, they were very gracious in this moment. My NCOIC went right around, because our shop was right around the corner, he went right around the corner and grabbed her, and she came running in with arms wide open, just ready to embrace me. And I jumped up from the chair again and I ran into her arms and I'm like, Logan, they killed my baby. They killed him. Why'd they kill my baby? And I'm crying into her chest and like her shirt was all wet from my tears. Like, so much I was crying. And she's hugging me and she's like, I know, Soriano, everything's going to be okay. And I'm like, no, it's not, you know. Took me a minute or two to calm down, but I calmed down. And then the sergeant major told me, we're going to treat it like you were married. And they were so gracious to me because I didn't realize they didn't have to do that. But they sent me home to bury him. They gave me an extra 15 days of emergency leave on top of the R&R I already had scheduled. So I got to take 30 days and go home it wasn't my home, but it was his home in Austin, in Texas, to meet his family, to be with his family, to accept the body, to bury him. And then they gave me the option after that to either go back to Afghanistan or go to Colorado. So they sent me home. But before they did, they told me the family hasn't been notified. So we have to keep you in your room. I was in my room for 12 hours, but I wasn't by myself. They put my roommate was in and out. They put my best friend in there and they put my direct line NCO, Sergeant Tejeda, like, because, you know, buddy watch and all that. I just remember trying to force myself to sleep. I was crying. I was just going through it. And I was just like, wake up from this nightmare. And I realized, like, it wasn't a nightmare. It was reality, you know? And as I was going through the process, went home, met his family. I was trying to stay strong for his family, especially for his mom. Like, this lady, I love this woman so much. And I admire her strength because I have a son of my own. And I couldn't imagine what she was going through. And I loved him so much that I knew the pain I felt. I can only imagine, like, you know, how much more it hurt her the person who brought him into this world and birthed him, you know. But I remember his body came back, and his older brother was the one to be with him to transfer the body from Dover to Austin. His older brother also served. And I remember seeing the casket come off the plane, and I lost it. Again, every ounce of discipline, every bit of me that was trying to be strong for his family, I lost it, and I cried until there was no more tears to cry. Like, I was to the point where I was just like heaving, like, like, you know, like there was nothing else in me to let it out. But I just couldn't accept it. And then it was so bad that they recommended a closed casket. And I remember thinking, because we weren't married, they weren't going to let me see his body. And I remember thinking, there is no way that I can bury him and have peace knowing that that is him in that casket if I don't physically lay eyes on him. His mom got to see him. I believe his father got to see him, and his older brother, of course, because he is the one that accompanied the body, got to see him. And I remember his mom coming out and wiping her tears and being strong and saying, you know, he looks good, and they're going to clean him up so that we can have an open casket funeral. And I was so thankful for that. But part of that is what haunted me for many years, because I did see his body. And the person I loved was definitely in that casket, but he looked so different because of all the damages. And I mean, there was damages to his skull. There was damages like to his neck. I remember seeing like this paper almost looked like paper mache. And I kept wondering, like, is that holding that together or is that covering something? And he had a ton of makeup on, but like, I knew that they were covering bruising or they were covering marks or whatever, you know, and he was so swollen and cold, and his beret didn't fit right because of the damage to his skull. And it hurt me so bad to see him like that. And that haunted me for years. For years, I had to go through some intense therapy to work through that. But in the process, like I said, I remember having that moment with him and just like kissing his hand and just saying, like, Mom, I'm so sorry. And like, I love you. And, you know, I tried to say goodbye, but I'm not sure that I actually was able to in that moment. If I'm being honest, it wasn't until like years later where I'm like going through the therapy process, you know. But the last part of this that I'll mention is I remember him being lowered into the ground. Like, I couldn't tell you anything that happened in that funeral because I was there but not mentally there. I don't know if that makes any sense, but like,
perfect sense.
I was physically there, mentally elsewhere, just trying to figure out, like, was this a dream? And I mean, I felt so crazy and insane because I'm like, I'm literally sitting here, but I'm thinking and it's a dream. Like, I'm thinking this isn't real. How could this be real, right? And I remember everybody started to depart as his casket was being lowered, and I just stood there. And there's this picture that my mom snapped of me that you could just see the despair in my face, like just the utter shock and like lack of emotion other than sorrow in my face. And I'm just standing there, and I remember being glued to that spot because I didn't want to say goodbye, because I knew that that was the last time I was ever going to see him. And that from that moment on, he'd be under, like, buried, you know, and underground. And I was just so stuck. And I remember crying and crying while everybody else was like going to the reception hall and all that. And my mom gave me a few moments, but after that, she walked over to me and she said, Michal, we have to go. And I didn't want to go, but I went. And I did end up going back to Afghanistan. I felt like I wanted to make him proud to finish out that deployment, because I did it for him anyway in the beginning, right? I volunteered.
Yeah.
To be on the cycle. Wanted to make him proud. And I just felt like there was nothing for me in Colorado. And my support system, my best friend, she was in Afghanistan. So I went back to Afghanistan. But it was like I had the plague. Nobody talked to me. I didn't.
What?
Girl, nobody talked to me. And that hurt so bad. My best friend did, of course. I had two friends that held me over. My best friend, Logan. I had a good friend named Rob Wenzel, who unfortunately is no longer alive to this day. But he used to be my workout buddy, and he pushed me so hard in the gym to let out every aggression and emotion that I had. And I'm so thankful for him. So thankful. And Logan, of course, she was there for me in any way that she could be. Everyone else, I forgive because I feel like if I was in that position, what is there that you can ever say? What can you say? There's nothing you can say. You know what I mean? And I think that a lot of people just didn't know what to say, so they chose not to say anything. And nobody talked to me. They avoided me, except for like here and there. I would get one sergeant, his name was Schuler, who would be like, hey, keep your head up, hey, you okay? And then my sergeant major, for a while, they put me at the front. They didn't know what to do with me. At that point, I had no more discipline. Like, you couldn't tell me nothing. Like, something in me snapped that I'm so surprised I wasn't demoted. I think they just had so much grace for me because of what had happened. If someone pissed me off, I went off. I didn't care if they were sergeant first class, didn't care who they were, what they were, nothing. I just lost it. And the only acceptable emotion at that time was anger. So I let that out in every chance that I could. But most people, again, didn't talk to me. So I was quiet. But the sergeant major here and there, he walked by, like, hey, you okay? You doing okay? And I'd be like, yes, sergeant major. So he was like my favorite sergeant major ever, just because I felt like he actually cared and checked up on me throughout that time. But for the most part, I know that I was a very difficult soldier, and I'm so thankful for the grace that they gave me, but that was hard. But I did complete that deployment, and I came back home, and I was so proud of myself. And I remember just like the redeployment ceremony and how emotional that was, and hearing like all the Toby Keith songs. I don't know if you know, like, all the patriotic songs, you know.
Yes.
Hearing the national anthem, I cry every time I heard the national anthem because it just felt different this time, you know.
Yeah.
And, Logan and I were the only two on that redeployment ceremony that didn't have any family waiting for us. Her family was coming down the following weekend with her car, you know, they were going to drive down, and my family, we just weren't in a good spot and just didn't really care at the time, so nobody was there. But she was there, and God placed her in my life for me to be with me during those moments. So I'm thankful for that.
Girl, that is a story. And it really got me in my feelings, I gotta say. Because, you know, anybody that has a heart gotta feel that. Anybody that served. There are so many of us that have lost people in action. But when you think about us, the person that you're going to marry, that you're planning to spend the rest of your life with, that you're so in love with, and you get that news. And then that's just so heartbreaking. And I understand. Well, first of all, we could do a whole episode on how anger is the only acceptable emotion. Okay. We could do a whole nother episode on that. Right. And how, you know, they weren't like, here, go to mental health to help you cope with this loss, you know, or the fact that everyone alienated and ostracized you on top of. So it's like a loss on top of a loss on top of a loss, because you lose who you were, because you're never like, that's one of those, what they say, put a pinpoint moment in your life, that you put that pin in that timeline of your life, and you're one person before that happened and a completely different person after that happened. So absolutely, not only did you lose this love of your life, you lost who you were with him.
Absolutely.
Leading up to that point. And not only that, you lost the future that could have been with him had that not happened. So then you're mourning not only him, but all of these things. And then you got to mourn the person you were in the command and the position and who you were. And because all of a sudden everyone's not talking to you except for, you know, your handful of people. So to me, like, that's just pain on top of pain on top of pain, which I definitely can understand how that would have come out in anger and just being short fused. And just, you know, there were quite a few things you said that I identified with. It wasn't my loved one, obviously, but when my father passed away, I was very young, and I had a lot of those same sensations seeing his body in the coffin there and like going through that. So I definitely feel your story like very deep. I know a lot of people will feel this story. If you haven't lost somebody you love so dearly, you can at least empathize with this story. And the surprising thing to me, though, still is that everybody stopped talking to you. Like that gets me kind of angry. That makes me kind of pissed, right? Because we often talk about like the camaraderie and the brotherhood and the sisterhood, and that's like the big like draw of being in the military, or the thing that we miss the most when we're out. But there are women that I've spoken to that from different experiences and during their time of service, they've gone through this period where everybody turned their back on them, and their brothers and sisters and their family just was gone in an instant through no fault of their own. They're the survivor of something, whether it be MST or some type of harassment or bullying or a loss like yours. And suddenly everybody you thought were your people, your family, and you're ostracized. So that, I think, really just touches my heart that you experienced all of that. And I'm just amazed because this was your first deployment.
Yes. So I joined when I was 18. I deployed from 19 to 20 years old, and I had just turned 20 because my birthday is in January, okay? January 20th. So he passed away and was killed in action February 13th. That means I had just turned 20 years old. So that shaped the rest of my life.
Yes. You're a baby.
With issues. Yeah. I was growing up. So again, I think a lot of the people, how I see it, was they just didn't know what to say. Mm-hmm. And so they avoided saying anything at all so as to not offend me. At least that's how I had to look at it.
Yeah.
Because if anybody did offend me, and not even about the situation, but about work, I snapped. And I think people were trying to avoid my wrath too, because I'm mm-hmm. telling you, I was enraged and just letting it out on all the wrong people. But again, they didn't send me to behavioral health until we came back. When we redeployed, they forced me to go to behavioral health. And I was scared because, you know, there was a stigma for PTSD and going to see mental mm-hmm. health. And I was just like, no, like my career is going to be over. Like, I didn't want to do it. And I remember my former first line NCO, her name was Lauren Wang. She was the one who was in charge of me over casualty. She said, I'll go with you and I'll ask if you can go see someone off post, which I didn't know you could do. So she talked to the provider or whatever. I had to talk to the provider, and I got to see somebody off post. So I never had to be seen going into the building at all. But the lady who I was first with, like, I don't know if I wasn't ready or she just wasn't the right therapist for me. I just didn't want to deal with her. Like, it just wasn't for me. So instead, I leaned into the wrong things. Like, I was drinking, I was partying heavily. I did experience MST. It was a very unfortunate. It actually happened to be one of Bobby's friends. He had convinced me to go over to get his memorial bracelet. And I went and I got it, but we drank too much and he took advantage. And I remember like waking up in his tub. And he was so scared trying to splash water on me to wake up because I was knocked out cold, but I was naked in his tub and I already knew what had happened. And I remember calling Logan to come get me because I think I even walked over there. It wasn't that far from my barracks. It was his barracks where they were. And I kept that to myself because I was an underage drinker at that time. And I didn't want to get in trouble for underage drinking. And I had also experienced like what happened to other females who had experienced MST in Afghanistan. Thank you, Jesus. I didn't experience it over there. But like the woman was sent back. The female soldier was sent back while the male stayed there, and the female soldier was ostracized. I didn't want even worse things happening to me because I had already gone through being silenced and all of that, like with the loss that I experienced. And I struggled with that because this person was a good friend of Bobby's, of my former fiance. And so it was hard. It was hard.
Can't even imagine like the layers of emotional trauma that a friend of your lost loved one, and then to take advantage of you in that way. And then again, We could do a whole nother episode on underage drinking in the military and the things that happen and why you stay silent because you're afraid of your career and what will happen to you. And that just seriously, like, so upsetting to hear that that is what happened to you and the experience. But I know that there's a lot of people listening to that that identify 100%. I, of course, had a conversation with another female veteran, and we talked about underage drinking and everything. And I shared my story for the first time on Asaya's story. So, I mean, but it that's also a whole nother topic we can dive into. And then the MST on top of that, you know, so I feel for everything that you must have been going through and experiencing emotionally, for sure.
What helped me was I threw myself into my work, honestly. I noticed that if I could keep my mind busy, I wouldn't have to struggle. The only time I struggled was at night. I had insomnia, like there was no tomorrow. And I was so against taking pills because they did throw pills at me, every kind of pill. But I was against it because, like I said, my dad struggled with addiction and I was scared to be addicted. So I just decided I wasn't going to do that. I think I took one of those pills one time. I can't even remember the name of that medicine. I don't even think they give it out anymore. But it caused hallucinations and all of that. And I remember having like a vivid dream and I was just like, oh, I can't do this anymore. Because in that dream, I had dreamed that Bobby said it was all fake, that he was in special operations, that like he was alive. And like, I just, it messed up my head so bad that I was just like, I can't do this. I'm not taking this pill. I'd rather just not sleep. Right. So I did struggle at night, but during the day I was fine because I threw myself into my work. And I remember they were sending me to all these schools and I was going up getting promoted because I was the soldier willing to take on almost everybody's load. Like, give it to me, whatever keeps me busy. I didn't like that to this day. I went to therapy for it too, because my therapist was telling me, Diana, don't do that again. Like, because that's my go-to, is just give me more, give me more, give me more. I don't like to just sit still. And that became an issue in itself too, because I didn't know how to rest. But for years I did that. And then I met my son's father, dated him for a year, got married, rushed into that because he was about to be on orders to Korea. We were gearing up for Afghanistan again. I was on something called the FET team, female engagement team. So a lot was going on, but things were looking up. And I remember getting married and then we went to Korea, fought a lot. Like, my marriage was, I wasn't fully healed from Bobby. And I take responsibility for that. But my marriage was rough. And we ended up getting to the point where we were hitting each other, yelling at each other, disrespecting each other. He stepped out on the marriage quite a few times. And I was so dedicated. Just like, I believe in my marriage. I didn't want to give up on my marriage. And I remember in our fourth year of marriage, I got pregnant. And I thought that was going to make things better. He had already previously been married and had a daughter with his high school sweetheart, whom he divorced before me. But I thought that it would bring me closer to him in the way that like they were close. And that just wasn't the case. And I thought it would bring me closer to his family in the way that their family cared for her and her daughter. And that just wasn't the case. We just weren't meant to be. And I picked the wrong one. But I was trying to deal with the cards that I was dealt. And I believed in marriage. I didn't want a divorce or anything. And 2 weeks after my son was born, I found out that he had gotten someone else pregnant. He had a whole girlfriend on the side while I was pregnant.
Wow.
Like, I could tell you, I have stories for days, but, you know, for the sake of time, I'm going to just rush through this. But she ended up aborting her baby, and I felt bad. I almost felt responsible for it. But then I'm like, you know what? I'm not the one who stepped out. That was him, you know, and he told her we were contract marriage. Like, I don't know what this girl believed, but, you know, she kind of knew he was married because he accidentally sent her a picture with his ring on. And he's like, oh, I'm contract marriage. And like, okay. But, you know, that's that. We tried to work on it, tried to like keep going. And my son was a year by the time we got divorced. But we were back and forth because I had already kicked him out, then tried to let him back in because I was trying to go back to church and like just, okay, I believe in my marriage. He's still my husband. But he couldn't stop cheating. Like, I remember having a physical trainer who told me, like, Diana, I seen your husband at Red Robin with another woman. Like, I know it's not my business, but I just want to let you know, you know?
Wow.
And I remember confronting him about that. And at this point, me and him are trying to work it out, right? I remember confronting him about that. He was so, like, upset and pissed off. Just, how do you believe other people? But, like, that's what he did, right? And so I remember after that, I was done. Just, like, done. And I begged my branch manager, like, please move me. At this point, we were in Washington State. Oh, and mind you, my son was, like, he went through some things. Like, he was on life support when he was first born. Like, he went through seizures, had all
this. Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was crazy because I didn't know what I was doing. I was a young mom. We're still in the hospital. I didn't know how to breastfeed. And I remember the nurse latching him onto me, and she was like, okay, he's good to go. And I'm like, I can't see his nose or his mouth. Like, how do I know if he's okay? Like, breathing. She's like, oh, I latched him on. He's okay. Well, he ended up not breathing. He ended up losing. I almost suffocated him with my boob. So I was afraid to breastfeed after that. I didn't breastfeed after that. But
oh, honey.
Yeah. And because of the loss of oxygen to his brain, it was about 10 minutes. I remember she walked out, left, came back in about 10 minutes later. And I asked her, like, take him off me because he stopped sucking. And I'm like, yeah, I think he's done. And whatever she did, she grabbed him and was going to swaddle him. But she must have pushed like a silent button or something, because all these doctors and nurses like rushed into the room, and I'm like, what the heck's going on with my baby? I couldn't see nothing. Right. And, after that, you know, they said there was loss of oxygen to his brain. He had like, he was put on life support because he couldn't breathe on his own. He had a cold cap, all this stuff. Meanwhile, my husband was cheating on me. Okay. Like, it was so much at one time. It was ridiculous. I dried up quickly from pumping because I was so stressed out. Like, I just had enough when I found out about the other women that he was cheating on me with. And he ended up, shortly after, I begged my branch manager to move me. We went to Hawaii, and come to find out, he had a whole other woman pregnant who he actually married and is married to her to this day, has more kids with now. But, like, there was just so much going on that I just couldn't stay in that marriage. There's no way we would have worked out any other way. So we did divorce.
Clearly.
Yeah. And I was confused because, you know, I did try my best. I did love him. I wasn't a perfect wife. I mistreated him a lot of times. I was angry wife all the time, complained a lot. I nagged a lot. You know, there was a lot that I did wrong too. It wasn't just him. I didn't cheat on him though. But I remember, like, just, we went through like, is it MRT where you learn like resilience training and all that? And I remember he was one of the people that I called, and I just said, you know, I'm sorry for the things that I did to you. Like, I'm sorry that I didn't treat you how you needed to be treated, you know. And we had that conversation, and we were okay. But I didn't know he had a whole wife and then, like, other kids, you know. Like, so I just had to move on, and I think God knew it was just time for me to just heal. And in Hawaii, I got to do that because you're surrounded by beautiful scenery and all this stuff, right? I used to take my son hiking, just carry him on my back. And it was good. We were there for a little bit. The only problem that I had in Hawaii was that I had relied on my ex-husband a lot to pick him up for me, because I was the person who would always stay late at work, right? And if I had to stay late, I'd be like, hey, can you pick him up, right? Well, in Hawaii, I didn't have that. I didn't have anybody. And that got really difficult. So at first, I had really great leadership. And then I transferred into a G1, which is like a higher echelon of the military. And I did that for career progression because I thought it would be best for my career. And when I got there, the sergeant major wasn't as supportive as the one before her. And that sergeant major was a single mom, but she had an 18-year-old and like an 11 or 10-year-old, something like that, maybe even 12, between that age, 10 to 12. And I had a 2-year-old, okay? And so she often sent me to the field, which they never deployed, but they stayed in the field for days, okay? And I would go. But the issue was that sometimes we had to be in the field at 3 o'clock in the morning. Sometimes we had to be there at 10 o'clock at night. It depended on when they were going to do the briefing. And she wanted me there for the briefing. Well, if you count the hours, right? Say I had to be there at 3 in the morning. That means I had to drop off my son 30 minutes prior to that to somebody. And it was out of daycare hours because daycare opens from 6 to 6. And if you were late, it was $1 a minute that you're late. They're charged, right? So I was trying to lean on Army spouses. And it got to the point where I'm leaving him with strangers because I don't have no other people, you know? But, like, people didn't want to open their door at 2:30 in the morning. Can you blame them? I couldn't blame them. But my sergeant major didn't want to hear it. And she didn't really support me. And she was like, either you figure it out or we're going to get you out. And I didn't believe her. I'm a staff sergeant, United States Army at this point. You know, I'm like, I'm mid-level NCO, you know, going to be boarded for warrant officer. I'm like, I'd never seen this happen. I was kicked out within 45 days. 45 days, I was out. And in that process, I didn't even get to do like my soldier for life process, like the out process, you know, where they prepare you for the civilian world was condensed to like 2 weeks and really quick. So I was not prepared. I had at that time, he had just turned three. I had a three-year-old with me and I lost my career, like everything I worked hard for. So it took some forgiveness for me to finally forgive her too. But I feel like my career was stolen from me because I was just about to be boarded for warrant officer. But I was upset and angry at the world. And I was like, you know what? Go ahead. Because I remember one of my lieutenants saying, well, have you ever considered foster homes, like foster care? And I'm like, I don't know who gave up their kids to foster care for the military, because if that's an option, someone did it. But that will never be me. I would never place like my kid up just for the military. And unfortunately, that's how it was. It's like military first, family later. Right? That's the reality of
it. Your baby don't come in the sea bag. That's what we used to hear.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I'm sorry. I almost lost my son, and I would never, ever, ever give up my son for the military. And so the military was done with me after 10 years, you know. I was really, really hurt. And I went back to Las Vegas where my family was on my dad's side. And that was a mistake because, you know, you don't go back to where you came from because it just ain't going to work. But I didn't know, you know, I'm learning because people are like, oh, you could stay with us. You could stay with us. And I did. I bounced around between three different family members for a while, trying to figure out like where I could go. I was trying to find a job. It took me 4 months to find a job. Like, it was hard because it happened to be right before like Christmas and all that. So it was holiday season. It was hard. I remember moving to South Carolina for a little bit. That didn't work out. Eventually, I came to Texas. I was in Austin with Bobby's family. They had told me when I first got out to come be with them, but I was scared because I had a son who wasn't their son's son, you know? And I'm like, how are they going to treat my son? But they were actually really good for the longest time. They were really good. They supported us. His sister let us stay with them. Within 2 weeks, I found a job in Texas. I love Texas. Shout out to Texas people. They take care of their veterans. I'm just saying. So 2 weeks, I found a job. 4.5 weeks later, I closed on this house, and life's been good ever since. It's been good, and I'm so thankful. Things didn't turn out how I wanted it to turn out, but they have turned out in a very good way for me and for my son. And I got out right before he started kindergarten. So I missed out on the first moments of his life. You know, like I wasn't there when he took his first steps. His father was. I was in ALC. I was struggling to potty train him. Someone else was like taking care of him. He was calling someone else mommy for a while. That hurt. But like, I was so thankful for her because she was there for me while she could be until she got transferred, you know, or her husband. But from kindergarten on, I've been able to be here for my son. And while it was a hot mess because I was dealing with PTSD and dealing with depression and struggling through all that, God bless my little son's soul because he's so patient with me. But I went to therapy and I got the help that I needed because I knew that he deserved the best version of me. And what I was giving him in the beginning just wasn't the best version of me. You know, it was the leftovers of all the stress and all that. And it wasn't fair to him. And I remember looking at his like little face and just being like, man, like I'm not going to mess him up the way that my parents like kind of messed me up as a kid, you know?
I feel that.
Yeah. And so I said, I'm going to break every cycle, break every chain. And I did. I went to therapy. My family don't believe in that stuff. You know, we're Hispanic and they're like, oh, you know, that's you. They just want to get your money or you don't need therapy, you know, or they'll lean into the wrong things. Right.
Mm-hmm. But toxic family units often say that kind of thing.
It is. Mm-hmm. But no, I said, I'm going to do different. I got therapy. I got into church. God has transformed my life in miraculous ways. Like we were saying earlier, I'm part of a homeless ministry. I'm giving back to homeless people because I feel like I resonate with them. You know, I was homeless. I just had people who helped me from church. There are people out there who have no one who helps them. You don't know their story. I like to know their story. And then I like to pray with them and just, you know, show them grace and love and compassion because somebody's got to. know what mm-hmm. I mean? And I'm teaching my son that. He comes with me when we go give out the donations. He prays for people, and I'm like, oh, he just makes me so happy. You know, like, I'm so proud to be his mom. I'm doing something right. I don't know what I'm doing right.
I'm sure you're doing a lot of things right. I'm sure of it.
Thank you.
I mean, going to therapy is hard work. Healing those wounds, going deep inside the pain and all the roots, like killing it. Like, you know, if you clip off the weeds, it just grows back. But you got to go in and dig out those roots. And that is hard. And people underestimate it. Actually, I don't know that that's true. I think people know how hard it is. That's why they don't want to do it. That's why they want to use drugs and alcohol and food and movies or whatever to escape and to just put a Band-Aid on all that instead of going deep within and doing all that work. I'm a huge advocate for therapy. I did therapy for years. I'm going back to the vet center tomorrow because I go back for tweaks. Like, I just keep it tight. You know what I mean? Like,
me too. And I do.
Like, sometimes I did therapy, I think, for 11 straight years. And then I stopped. And then I spent time, you know, using the tools that I learned. Mm-hmm. And now every now and again, I go back when moments get difficult in my life, like that support, even just someone to listen, that's not like a close relative, family friend, like someone who's like not in it or too close to it, that can be objective and are just sometimes just listen. Like, I think that's super helpful. And I think that's a great message that you have about, you know, not being too proud to seek that help. And even coming from a military environment where it's like stigmatized. Like, again, we could do a whole nother episode on the stigma of mental health, right? In the military, the fact that you actually needed to go off base because you didn't want anybody to see you going in and out of the building. Like, and that was a benefit for you. That shouldn't even be necessary, right? So, I mean, we could just talk endlessly about so many of the things the issues that you brought up and the things that you went through. But it's an amazing story that you have, and for you to be still so young and so, you know what I mean? Like, you've lived two, three lives, you know? How about the medical malpractice of the latch nurse not latching your baby on correctly and nearly causing your baby to die? Imagine that trauma.
You can't sue the army. So what they did was they gave me a free, it was like Moderna or Modella, something like that. Moderna, started with an M, a free breast pump, because, you know, they felt bad about the situation.
They gave you a breast pump?
Yeah, because you can't sue the army. And they knew it was the nurse's fault, but they didn't want to say that. So they gave me a free breast pump because I refused to breastfeed after that. I mean, who would? You know, I was scared.
Yeah, that's trauma.
So that's what they gave me, and that's what I did until I dried up, because there was just so much going on around me at the time that I was just so stressed out. I couldn't produce.
I mean, I completely understand. When my son was born, I couldn't get him to latch on partially because I was so full of anxiety. I have large breasts, right? And I was so scared of that. So when you were talking about that, girl, I was really feeling that, because I was so scared that I could never get my oldest to latch on. I pumped until I dried up, and then I had to give him formula because I was so, like, when I tell you I was really scared, I was really scared. So when you told me that story, I was like, mind blown.
That is good though, because my son was supposed to die. He was on life support. I'm telling you, the doctors were like getting ready to get me through the process, like, all that stuff. Right. And I kept praying and begging God, and like, not my son, God, not my son. Like, I've already been through so much. Like, please let me keep my son. And I prayed him through that. And then after he survived and they called him a miracle, they said, okay, he's going to have cerebral palsy. He's not going to be able to meet his milestones. He's not going to be able to walk. He may not be able to talk. He may not be able to learn. If you look at him today, you would never know he went through any of that. He is a normal boy, strong, and just he's a miracle. And I'm so thankful for
miracle
that.
Baby.
Like, y'all tell me whatever you want to tell me, but I know what I've experienced. You know what I mean? Like, God has been great in my life. But despite any negative thing, any unfortunate circumstance, like, God's been there for me, you know? And so I'm just so thankful for that. I'm thankful. That's given me a lot of peace of mine and been able to extend that same grace to other people because, you know, everybody's been through some stuff. Everybody mm-hmm. has a story.
Yeah, it's the truth. It's the truth. And I love what you're doing with your homeless ministry, because I actually, there are two reasons why this podcast exists. Well, it comes down to two articles I read in 2018. And one of them was about the suicide rate amongst female veterans being 250% higher than their civilian counterparts. So that's not like 5, 20, even 100% higher, right? That's astronomical. And I thought, oh my God, my female veteran sisters are out here just dying. Like,
I was there.
Something, somebody got to do something. Somebody got to share, like give them a platform. And it led to someone actually telling me the best thing I could do for female veterans was to give them a platform. And how I met that woman was she was the outreach coordinator at the Vet Center in LA, in Culver City, actually. And we were there, me and one of my friends, she was a business mentor of mine, but we're now friends. And she was the one who was like, you should be speaking out on female veterans issues. Cause we were at lunch and I was just going off about this article I'd read about female veteran homelessness and about the suicide rate. And so we went, she's a doer. So she was like, let's go to the Vet Center. Let's go. Where can we go to help some homeless female veterans? So we went to the Vet Center to find out where we could find some homeless female veterans so we could get food and supplies and go pass it out and just take some action, even in one day. We were in Los Angeles for like, I think like 3 or 4 days or something like that. And so she was going to spend a day and we were going to do this, right? And the outreach coordinator said, if you really, she said, it's nice that you want to do that, but if you want to help these women, give them a voice. She's like, because we don't get donations for the females. She's like, and what they have to do is take what's left after the men. So they get shoes, boots, clothes that don't even fit half the time. They just have to take that. And she's like, we might get a blanket from the hospital where they make these quilts. We might have some of those to pass out to them, but that's about it. If you want to do something that's really meaningful to help these women, you go, you give them a voice. And that is how this podcast was born. So it's really close to my heart what you're doing. And I wanted to ask you, before I ask you my final question, I want to ask you, how can we support this? How can we support your ministry?
So I'm actually one of the members, but it's actually my friend Sammy who leads the ministry. Mm-hmm. He's also a fellow veteran, and he still works with the Army as counterintelligence, but as a civilian. Mm-hmm. And so what we do is we collect donations. So what I do is I post on Facebook, my neighborhood page, hey, if y'all got clothes, if y'all have shoes, blankets, backpacks, luggage you don't use no more, bring it. You could drop it off my doorstep and I'll take it to the homeless. So like we do that every last Monday of the month. But there is an Amazon link that I can get y'all that my friend Sammy and a couple other people in our homeless ministry post. And it's like things that we don't even think of, like flashlights, shaving cream, because a lot of people will say they give us razors, but they don't give us shaving cream. And, you know, that razor burn is something. Mm-hmm. So things like that, headlight, little headlight things that they get, or a little backpack. So I can share the Amazon link if y'all want to bless the ministry in that way to send it through there. And then we go out and hand it out. So we're basically the hands and the feet because we take what we get and we give it out and then pray over them.
Well, I think that's amazing. I would definitely like to have that link. As you will know, I will put it in the show notes, which is the description of this episode. Once you read a little bit about Diana's story and that, scroll down and you'll see the link. So please, please, please go donate. Go donate and help these people because somebody's got to. And there's so many of them. I live outside of Portland. I live north of Portland, Oregon. And that city is full of homeless people, right? So they need help. Then there's all sorts of like tent cities around this area. You know, reminds me of what they used to say about the Great Depression and when people be living in those little shanty towns, and we're living in that again today. So we need to do our parts to help out, whether it's veterans, whether it's not, just these people are people. And if we can't, what we can do, if we can't be boots on the ground, at least we can just reach into our pocketbook and $1, $5, $20, $100, $1,000, whatever is comfortable to you, is something that you can say that you made a difference. You don't have to be a multimillionaire to be a philanthropist. You just have to have the heart to give. So thank you so much, Diana. I got to say, I'm just blown away by you. And with that, I got to ask you, if there was any advice that you would have for our veteran sisters coming behind you, what would it be?
Thank you so much for having me on the show, first and foremost. I really appreciate you continuing to reach out to me and linking up with me so that we can get this done. I would say that everybody has a story to share. So don't be afraid to share yours, because you never know who you're going to help through sharing your story. And that's just speaking on your experiences, because a lot of people can resonate with different things within your story. And just knowing that you can get through that and you can overcome that can help them, because if they're facing those same issues, they can realize, well, if she can do it, I can do it too. You know, and I can definitely say, I know there's half 50-50, you know, some people believe in God, some people don't, but I will say that I have full faith in God, and anything that has been brought to me that I thought I couldn't get through, that I just, how would I have the strength to face this? I will say that if God brings you to it, he will get you through it. I experienced so much hurt and pain and loss, but through each and every one of those circumstances, God gave me strength to get through. And I'm now using my story to help build other people up, to encourage other people, and to just give them that strength and that encouragement and motivation. Like, hey, you can do it too. I'm not the only one. I ain't nobody special. I'm a regular person in this world, just another veteran, another female in this world. But I've overcome a lot, and I wouldn't have been able to do that on my own. So that would be my advice, is just lean into God. You know, he'll get you through.
A beautiful message. And I want to thank you so much for sharing your story with me and feeling like this is a safe space to share and go as deep as you did. I really appreciate you. And I know how hard it is to be the one that has to break cycles and to heal ancestral wounds. And I'm just stand in awe of your resilience and just am so impressed by everything you've done and everything you're doing. It's been a great honor to have you as a guest today.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much. I appreciate you so much. Thank you for allowing my voice to be heard today.
And with that, we're going to wrap it up. I want to say to everyone, thank you so much for coming on this journey with me. Remember that you can support my sponsor, Rent Style, still a company that I love and respect, and they do great work in the world, owned by veterans and employ over 200 veterans on their staff, and they have a great foundation. So don't forget to use them. You can still use my code Baker, and you get 10% off your first order. So support them as well. Support this homeless ministry. I'll put all the details in the description box. And don't forget to share and like this episode, and stay tuned for the Female Veterans Podcast coming to YouTube. It's not going to be video, but you'll be able to listen to it on YouTube. It's just another platform to get our stories out. So go and support that. Keep an eye out, set your notifications, all of that good stuff. And I love you guys, and I'll talk to you next time.